We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. What do we got? Oh, gas. Have you noticed? Hovering around $1.65 around the greater Toronto Hamilton area. Alicia in Vancouver, where apparently Jagmeet Singh says they don't have a federal carbon tax. No, because they've got two of their own provincial carbon taxes, and their gas is coming in at $2.10 to $2.18 this week. So there you go. Did you remember Jagmeet Singh on the show yesterday screaming about that? About Pierre Poilievre calling it a federal carbon. If you don't implement your own, then the feds will put one on you. Either way you slice it, it's a carbon tax. All right, we'll leave it up to them. Also, wait lists in Canadian hospitals are up again right across the country, result of overpopulation, just too many people searching for too few services. And Oakville Ford is delaying its EV production at the Oakville Assembly Plant until 2027. Reason being, this is interesting, the consumer market needs more time to develop. In other words, grow. There's not a market there. Same thing with the development of EV production. It's going to be interesting where that goes after the delay. Obviously going to go, but it's going to take a bit more time. Jeez, haven't we all said that? What else? Oh, the Justin Trudeau pre-budget roadside distraction tour continues. Where is it today? Huh? Where? Oh, Winnipeg. It's in Winnipeg today. And what, you know, forget the countdown calendar. We need a drum roll for this. Simply because every day, it's like a telethon. The amount goes up, and he was in Winnipeg. So far, Justin Trudeau, since he has announced the budget, has spent $25 billion. Or is it million? I don't know. I think it's billion. Is it billion or million?
Ba-ba!
There you go. And he's in Winnipeg selling more housing stuff, which really is just a rehash of stuff we've already talked about or that housing experts or the opposition has already suggested. I don't know. Is the trust gone? States the obvious. Doesn't do much. Are people still listening to the pre-budget rollout, which, of course, the budget coming up on April 16th. And every day since last week, he's rolled out another $1 billion or several billion dollars on it is billion. Yes. On various programs. And people are starting to ask, well, where the hell's the money coming from? Like, what do you how are we going to do this? Anyway, that's where we are with that. All right. The inquiry into the foreign interference in the last two elections continues, and it is getting more and more telling as time goes by, and specifically how Justin Trudeau called that election in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic and in the middle of the accusations of Chinese interference in the last two elections. Put his head down and go. And of course, it was all about winning back his majority. Didn't get that. So made a sweet deal with the NDP. And we all know where that is. All right. We'll update you on that as well. And Kiss selling its back catalog. A lot of artists have been doing this, over the course of the years. And the whole, you know, idea is somebody else manages their music. They get their money up front. And the music lives on forever in various forms. Many shrugged this at the beginning, but obviously, the payday helps. And the thing is after every artist, it seems to go up. So, I mean, I don't know. What are you holding out? I'm going to hold out and see what these guys get. And then maybe we'll go from there. But Kiss, selling the back catalog for $300 million, which of course not only gives them the money up front, but, now you're going to hear their music everywhere. But wait a second. Are we not already? So, there you go. More on that coming up a little later on as well. All right. Balance return to the Hamilton real estate market. We'll talk about that coming up, in a little bit as well. Also, I mentioned this earlier, but it was Jagmeet Singh came on the show yesterday and he wanted to talk about groceries and I totally led him astray. And he started screaming about Pierre Poilievre saying that BC has a carbon, has a federal carbon tax. We went back and we listened to it. And it's, this federal carbon tax. And of course, it's not a federal carbon tax because BC implemented its own carbon tax, of which there are two. So, he's just screaming and yelling about this on the show yesterday. And you let him go. You can't get a word in either way. And I tried, but by the time we got to this point, I didn't have anything left to pin on him. So, off he went, but it was very bizarre. And then we played the clip back and it was like, no, he said, Pierre Poilievre is lying to Canadians because he says BC has a federal carbon tax. Of course, they don't have a federal carbon tax because the Liberal government 16 years ago implemented a carbon tax. It's not federal, it's provincial. And there's two of them, and it's way more than what we're paying, which is why we're hovering around $1.65 a liter now, and Vancouver's up around $2.10 to $2.18. So I don't know. Again, another roadside distraction. Here we go. And just as bad as his boss, Justin Trudeau, it's amazing. So in all of that, we start getting texts and social media, what's he saying? So Dan McTagg picked up on all of that. He got notes as well. So we're going to clarify what Jugmeet said and play his clip back for you coming up in just a bit. All right, lots to do and so little time. Balance has returned to the Hamilton real estate market for the first time in nearly a decade. What does that mean? Let's bring in Julie Sergi, VP Real Estate Association of Hamilton Burlington, and here now. Julie, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Julie, what does balance mean after a decade? Let's go with that. What does balance mean? And then we'll dwell into what's been happening.
Sure. Yes. It just simply means that we're seeing more houses come on the market. So there's better inventory for buyers to choose from. Not really much competition out there. And more homes in more price ranges, giving buyers some chance to shop around.
So, in other words, and you don't want to say this because obviously we know what the housing situation is, but it's buyers to sellers. It's balanced out. There's choice. There's options for both sides.
There is, yeah.
So, what about
a little more in the higher price ranges? Obviously, in the lower price ranges, they do tend to sell a lot more quickly because there is a larger pool in that price point, but there's still more coming up in that lower price point as well.
So obviously we're heading towards a more balanced a market. We'll talk about that in a sec. What's the last decade been like compared to where we are now?
Well, I'm sure you remember back during COVID, we had just some really high prices and a lot of competition, people paying a lot higher than what the listed price was, and houses were flying off the market. There wasn't enough supply for all the people looking. And now that's just kind of slowed down. Obviously, interest rates had a big impact on that. So that's sort of one of the main reasons we're seeing the market come back to more of a balanced.
And as you're alluding to, Julie, it looks like the interest rate situation has at least stabilized. There's chatter of by the end of the year, perhaps even a cut by a quarter point or so. Obviously, that's had an effect. How do you see the spring then in the summer months moving forward on this? Are you expecting a busy time?
I think it will still be busy. It's certainly been picking up over the last couple of weeks. Buyers don't want to sit and wait until the interest rate comes down too much, because then we could see an uptick in activity, and we don't want to see that competitive market again for these buyers, especially in the price points that are more attainable for first-time buyers that are coming into the market.
Obviously, as we've seen, affordability become an issue. Interest rates, as you've talked about, people are watching the finances more. Economic activity has slowed down. We're seeing that slowly, hopefully reverse as what you're suggesting, and even interest rates going coming down, creating more activity. Are you concerned that we might end up back where we were as soon as things start to settle down? Or, is this the new norm and it's not what it was, say, 3 years ago?
I would say this is going to be, it'll maintain this sort of balanced market for a little while, because even with the rates coming down maybe a quarter point, they're still higher than what people are used to. Right. And with house prices also being high, there's not a lot of wiggle room on, you know, throwing in those bids that are way over what the list price was.
So it's certainly
different.
So you're not necessarily expecting like the barn door to swing open this spring and summer?
I'm not, no.
You talked also, Julie, about all types of housing. Expand on that in why you think that's the case now.
Well, some of the higher price points, you know, there's more selection. So anyone who is looking to get into that house, it's a good time to put their first house that they purchased on the market, because these first time home buyers are out there looking to get into the lower price range. And then that will be able to bump you up, where in the higher price ranges before, where you might have had to have competed and paid a lot more, there is a lot more to choose from, and you have the opportunity to negotiate your price point.
Well, I guess the advantage there, Julie, is if you're seeing it on the larger or the higher priced homes, as those people decide to move up, that frees more starter type homes.
Exactly.
So that being said, with variety, are we seeing, you know, starter homes? Are we seeing smaller homes, townhomes, and opportunities for people who are just getting in for the first time? What's that situation like? Is it still
There's
pretty
definitely,
tough?
Definitely. Hamilton has reported over 200 homes available, sort of in that $600,000 to $800,000 range, which is nowadays kind of considered that sort of lower end market, which doesn't seem like it should be, but and in Burlington we're seeing a lot less in that kind of price range. So the more those become available, it frees up even homes that are sort of in the lower price, under 500, come up, and those will be more of your small starter homes or town homes or even some condos as well.
So if you're sitting on the fence, might be a good idea to wade back in.
It's a good time. It's definitely a good time to get into the market. The buyers are starting to get out there and look. And if you've got a great house and it's priced market value, you will sell.
Julie Sergi with us, VP Real Estate Association of Hamilton Burlington. The real estate market starting to balance out after some roller coaster years over the last decade. Julie, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
This was fascinating because yesterday we had Jagmeet Singh on, leader of the federal NDP party, and they wanted to come on and talk about grocery prices and, you know, the fight between him and Galen Weston and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I sort of sidetracked him and got him talking about other things and, you know, the whole propping up the government and what have you. And he sort of went on a tear and he started calling Pierre Poilievre a liar because he was trying to tell people that there's a federal carbon tax in British Columbia, and there's not, because British Columbia has their own, and they have had their own for 16 years. So if you have that, then you don't have to have one imposed on you. I'm not sure why this became a point other than a distraction, but it's one of those things when you're, well, like when they say, if we cut the rebate, if we cut the carbon tax, you don't get your rebate check. And you sort of, for the first 5 minutes, just shaking your head going, what did they say? Well, here's what he said.
Pierre Poilievre, for example, does not care about people. He's lying to two of the largest provinces. He knows. He's a smart guy. He knows that BC doesn't have a federal tax. They don't have one at all. But he's holding axe attacks rallies in BC, lying to people's faces. He's done it in Quebec. Quebec doesn't even have a carbon tax, period. They have a cap and trade system. It's an entirely different system. And don't tell me that Pierre Poilievre doesn't know this. He knows this. But he's not interested in helping people. That's not his goal.
I'm not sure what his point was, because no matter how you slice it, it's still a tax. And I'm thinking that's how the Canadians interpreted what Pierre Poilievre said. And you know what they say about lipstick on a pig? Let's bring in Dan McTagg, who, oddly enough, sent us a note on this because he got some chatter about it, too. Dan, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I was until, Scott, you did that interview yesterday, and then my phone lit up. So thank you for doing that. You made my day interesting.
You go ahead. Tell me what happened and how you found out about this.
I got three emails. I got two Twitter comments. I got two phone calls. And one of the two, I'd never even heard of the person before, but they were pretty upset with what Jagmeet had said. I, of course, was not listening. I apologize. But I was probably dealing with CKNW, your sister station out in Vancouver, with the 7 cent a liter increase, compliments of what was going on out there. And that's blocking pipelines and having not one, but two, get a load of it, two carbon taxes. So the irony wasn't lost on me. And I thought, well, I'm going to get a hold of Will and say, I'm not sure exactly what they said, but judging by, I never get this kind of reaction to any media, much less Scott Thompson. I thought I gotta investigate, poke around a little further. I can see exactly, or at least hear exactly what Mr. Singh had to say, and he was a little too cute by half. Let's put it that way, because they do have a carbon tax.
And honestly, and you know, you've been a politician, and I'm a radio guy, so I should be good at this stuff. But I was kind of dumbfounded. And they come at you in certain ways. It's like, well, by the time you figure out what's going on, you know, they've already left the building. And I was sort of stunned as to what he was saying, because he made it sound like there was no carbon tax in BC. And in fact, what he was doing is, no, it's not a federal tax, it's a provincial tax. And you know, on the rant he goes. And I don't know. Again, I think they came on to talk about groceries and we weren't going there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I could go down that road as well. But and because the NDP and the Liberals are copying the work that I'd done 20 years ago on preventing a grocery monopoly. But I digress. What Mr. Singh did not tell people was that, in fact, BC sat down with Trudeau and said, whatever your number is, we're going to follow it to a T, because we have our own system, yes. But they made sure that it was identical to the federal system, save and except the rebates. The rebates only go back to about a third, and the rest just put in general revenue so they can virtue signal and get everybody taking e-bikes and skateboards and EVs. So, but what he avoided skillfully, and this is to Polyev's point, not only does BC have one carbon tax of 17.61 cents a liter as of April the 1st, same time, same amount, pretty much the same thing. They have a second carbon tax, the BC low carbon fuel standard. And I was on Global TV out in BC this morning reminding people it's 18 cents a liter. So not only do you have tax number one at about 18 cents, you have tax number two, which is 18 cents. Add that with GST, Scott, the two carbon taxes that the NDP loves provincially and federally. That works out to about 18% of your fuel bill. You don't think that's inflationary? Because last time I checked, the Bank of Canada uses gasoline and diesel as an extremely important part of the makeup of inflation. And when you have an automatic 18% added on, the federal government and provincial governments can take off in a split second, as the provincial government did here in Ontario. It gets a little rich to try to make point fingers and say, oh, Mr. Polyev got it wrong by one word. The reality is that it's hurting BC, and this tax is hurting the rest of the country, and it's making the cost of everything go through the roof.
I don't think it had anything to do with federal or provincial. It was just a chance for him to yell that Pierre Polyev's lying to Canadians. And I just thought, where the hell is he going with this? Yeah. And in the headline today, Vancouver has a full-blown housing crisis, 106% of income needed in order for the average person to buy a house. So they're now for the rich. So where's that going? I mean, here's where they are as a result.
Well, where they are is that no one can afford to live in downtown Vancouver. You can't heat your home and you can't drive there. And if you do drive there, you can't afford the rent, much less the cost of housing. So you're going to see a significant depopulation in those areas, and businesses will decamp, save and except those businesses that are funded by rather shady, you know, cross-Pacific arrangements, such as people with no incomes now winding up owning multi-million dollar homes. That we know that there's been a number of loopholes raised by the Bureau and other organizations that have demonstrated that there is a significant amount of, jiggery pokery going on with how mortgages have been given, and artificially drove up the price of housing. Of course, always under the watchful eye of CMHC and the federal government, the provincial government. So someone's got to have some explaining to do, but I can tell you, if you're going to bring in a million new people into this country every year, they got to live somewhere. You better have, 500,000 homes built. Last time I checked, less than 40,000.
You're going to hear a lot, and we hear a lot that and it's picking up steam because the government is on a full-fledged promo campaign now with the budget and so on, that the Conservatives have no plan. It seems to be focused more on industry, less on taxing the consumer, although they're not unveiling any of that until an election's called. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, how is the country going to afford this? It's a problem of their own making. It's kind of like saying, hey, we created this problem. We're going to come up with what we think is a Band-Aid solution by spending more money, by going further into debt, and by, again, eliminating the very industries that keep our economy afloat by through productivity, but also through competitiveness, through prices. We're making our talk about something called carbon leakage. Your business in Canada, why would you want to stay here and do business when you can cross the border, go to the United States, go to a jurisdiction that doesn't have all these regulations and carbon nonsense, and then at the same time, be able to sell right back into the country? You know, Scott, we're losing on almost every front. And for the federal Liberals, my old party, to come out and say, we have a solution to the problem that we made and you don't have that solution, I have a better idea. And I think it's where the Conservatives are going. So we'll replace you altogether. That way there is no problem and the solution will be at hand. They've touched every single file and made a mess of everything. I just wish they had the experience. Look, when Justin Trudeau took over in 2015, he kicked out all of the experienced Liberals, those who've been around for a long time, who had, not people just like myself, but many others who had extraordinary amounts of experience, talents, well-respected by business, well-respected by labor, well-respected by the civil service, all gone. And what you're left with is a bunch of folks that know how to spend, but don't know how to do a whole hell of a lot more other than virtue signal and get involved with cancel culture and make an embarrassment of their performance in government. I don't think there'll be a Liberal party elected for quite some time after we have finished with this particular clown show.
Former Liberal MP Dan McTagg, and of course talking about yesterday's visit with Jagmeet Singh. And by the way, what is the price of gas in Vancouver today?
212.9 going to 214.9. And by the way, you're not off the hook. 164.9 top end here in Hamilton. On Saturday, it'll be 166.9, and you're going to be $1.75 by about the 18th of April. Mark my words. I'll be back to talk about it then, Scott.
All right, Dan. Thanks for the time. Be well. We remember when the Prime Minister and the Premier went to Oakville and talked about expansion of their EV production line in Oakville and that plant, and it's part in this. Now we have found out that Ford Oakville is delaying its EV production until about 2027 at the Oakville plant. And they say, quote, the consumer market needs more time to develop and allow for further development of EV battery production. We certainly know that the sale of EV vehicles is rising continuously every year. Where does this leave things? Let's bring in Marvin Ryder, professor at DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University, and here now. Marvin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Glad to be with you.
So, Marvin, this is a delay. It's certainly not a cancellation, although it does certainly crimp some plans from for people. What are your thoughts? Is this low demand in the United States? Is it an overall business plan? What are your thoughts?
Well, let's put in a little context, if we can. Most of the major world powers, the United States and Canada included, have said that they'd like to see all new vehicles sold by the year 2035 to be zero emission vehicles. Now, zero emission vehicles could be hydrogen power vehicles, but they could also be electric vehicles. And so we have 11 years from now till then. If I'm a car company and I hear a statement like that, I think, well, I'd better get myself ready. And so Ford quite correctly said, I want to modify my plants and move forward. In the case of Oakville, they were going to build a three-row electric-powered SUV. So these were bigger things. These aren't cars. These were bigger things that were going to be built there. And what they've seen happen over the last 6 months is that the demand for electric vehicles has slowed. It hasn't gone to zero, but it's slowed, and it's not where they thought it would be at this time. In fact, what they've noticed is, at least in the United States, that hybrid vehicles, vehicles that run both on gasoline and on electric batteries, those sales are actually stronger than they had projected. So what they've done is shift. You don't build cars to put in inventory. You try to match your production to demand. If the demand for electric vehicles is not as strong as they had wanted it to be, they're shifting demand. But what does that mean for Oakville? Well, their original plan, as they were going to convert it, was going to start in the second quarter of this year. basically shut down all the production work, install all the new technology, and then roughly a year from now, in the third quarter of 2025, they were going to start pumping out electric vehicles. What they've announced today is, well, they're going to move ahead with the modification. They're still going to spend the money, $1.8 billion, to produce the electric vehicles, but they're not going to actually start making them until 2027. So that means workers who thought they would have a job there in the third quarter of 2025, they're going to be laid off for a period of a year and a half. And Ford has announced they're going to work with the United Auto Workers to try to come up with something, I guess some pay, whether it's severance pay or not, to get people through all of this. But it's simply the case is when you're shifting from one kind of a technology to another, it's a little hard to predict how fast consumers are going to react. And the bottom line is they're not reacting as quickly, at least as Ford had thought.
I've read that Toyota more interested in hybrid than EVs for the reason that Ford is not is slowing its opening of the Oakville plant.
Yep.
In regard to EVs. Could you see this changing other car companies' priorities? Say, you know what, EVs are good, but this is what we need right now. And even would that affect goals for the government in the future? If it's the way to go or the better technology?
Well, I'm not sure it's the better technology, but you have to try to keep up with consumers, and where consumers lead, you follow. Now, we're old enough, I'm afraid, Scott, you're old enough, you and I are old enough to remember when compact discs were introduced, and in less than 18 months, the old record album business almost completely disappeared because of it. That technology was adopted much faster than anyone imagined. In this case, it is going not as fast as people had imagined, but that's for now. Again, a great example of this, Ford says they're going to still convert the plant. If consumers shift yet again and suddenly embrace EVs in a big way, they'll ramp that back up and change their plans yet again. And this is the challenge as you try to move people forward. So you're right. Many of the major car companies have noted that consumers are more willing to buy hybrid vehicles. So they're shifting the balance in their production between EVs and hybrid vehicles. And that's where the consumers are today. But if the consumers change their minds, even to the point if consumers suddenly say, no, damn it, I'm going to stick with internal combustion engines and I'm not buying electric vehicles under any circumstance, again, the car companies will adjust to that point. The bottom line is they've got to match production to what the consumers are demanding.
Marvin Ryder, professor at the Groot School of Business, McMaster University, Ford delaying its EV production at the Oakville plant until 2027. Marvin, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
I will. Glad to be with you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
Obviously, it was a while ago we realized that April 8th was going to be quite a big day. I'm not sure all of us realized how big this was going to be. But one of the, I guess, sort of previews of all of this was Niagara Falls and how all of a sudden bookings went through the roof and they're predicting like a million people and all of this. And it's all about the path of totality or the zone of totality, which means a pathway across the planet where there is actual a complete shadow, complete darkness with the solar eclipse. Either side of that, you see a bit of it. You don't see, you don't get as much. Whereas where we are, it's going to be nighttime for that split second or split seconds for that minute or so, around 3:18, I believe it is 3:15 in our area. So obviously Niagara Falls doing well, but what about every other area, as in Hamilton or Burlington or what have you? This is actually getting worldwide attention. I saw it last night on late night TV, who are covering the story. I believe it was on Colbert that Niagara Falls had declared a state of emergency. So, yeah, there seems to be a massive interest, and we've known that for weeks, and it's even overflowing out of the traditional tourist cities into places like Hamilton, we hear. Ryan McHugh is with us, manager of tourism and events, City of Hamilton, here now. Ryan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Ryan, are you noticing an uptick? Are we getting the same thing here?
Yeah, we're going to be busy. And, it's something where, first and foremost, public safety, we're not in a spot, thankfully, where we have to call a state of emergency like they do down the road in Niagara Falls. But we are expecting an influx of visitors, and to locals, we really encourage them, to view the eclipse from their yard, view it from a local park, And we have set up some designated preferred viewing sites where if they're coming in from out of town, go to this space because there's washrooms, there's parking, it's accessible. But we're expecting a very large crowd, and we just want to make sure everyone comes, enjoys a spectacular solar eclipse, and gets home safely without clogging up highways and roads and you name it.
Ryan, is this all on a website somewhere, all the official do's and don'ts?
Absolutely. So Hamilton, www.hamilton.ca/solar eclipse, and all the information you need. And one thing I really want to stress to your listeners, and hopefully this isn't news to anybody, but you shouldn't look at the sun, whether there's an eclipse or not. That's harmful for your eyes, but you do need proper eyewear. So there are special ISO-approved eclipse viewing glasses, and we have been distributing them through various city locations. Currently, there are glasses remaining at our Tourism Hamilton Visitor Center in the Lister Block building on James Street North. We do also have, on the day of the eclipse, 5 preferred viewing sites, and free glasses will also be handed out there. And those sites are Tim Hortons Field, which all of the 10,000 allocated seats have been accounted for. So we're essentially the east side bleachers, which will have a nice view of the sun, will be full.
Wait. So you've already 10,000 seats are spoken for?
Absolutely. So they all went, and they're free tickets, free glasses. So that's full. And that was really, because that's the other sites. There's Bayfront Park, Pier 4, Confederation, and TV McQuesten. Really, that's a park. So as many people come, we may have run out of glasses, but there's really no cap, right? It's a park. You can park your car. You can go appreciate it. But once we saw Tim Hortons Field tickets go like that, we realized we're in for a lot of visitors. And I can tell you as well, our hotels, they've seen, especially after Niagara Falls declared a state of emergency, the rooms started to go quick. And speaking with a dozen local hotels today, they're forecasting complete occupancy for the Sunday before the eclipse, and even into the Monday, a significant uptick, which is not usual for a Sunday and Monday in April, as you can imagine.
That is fabulous. Ryan, did you ever think when you became manager of tourism and events, you'd be setting up a page for a solar eclipse?
No, I came into this role during the dark days of COVID. So there was that. And then beyond that, a solar eclipse. And even, I know, Scott, I think I was on your show 2-3 weeks ago talking about it. And even I at that time couldn't anticipate it would be that big. But, I was reading and doing my research on that so I can be able to come and give your listeners this information. But they say this is the Super Bowl of astro-tourists. So there is people that will travel far and wide to view these because it is really a rare event. The next time there's a total solar eclipse in Hamilton, similar to the one we're going to experience on Monday, won't be for another 120 years. So don't think I'll be around to be a subject matter expert on that, but really expecting a ton of people. Hotels will be full. Hopefully our restaurants are packed, but at the end of the day, we just want everyone to get home and be able to, travel to where they're traveling to safely without an unreasonable amount of congestion. And we're just unsure of how many people will come, but we're ready to make sure people navigate the city safely.
And of course, all of this information on the city's website of where you can get or sites you can go to and glasses that are available. We've had people text or email in regard to taking pictures. You really shouldn't use, whether it's a selfie or whatever, you point your camera at this, it's the same as your eye. That's what I've heard.
It really is. And there's apparently a special filter, which would allow you to photograph this or film this successfully. But most amateur photographers, and certainly not your smartphone, would be equipped for that. So to prevent doing some damage to your phone, I recommend you don't take pictures, as tempting as it will be, and definitely wear the proper eyewear because you don't want to hurt yourself. And I know under normal circumstances, if you stare at the sun, your eyes tell you this hurt, I'm going to stop. Yeah. During the eclipse, you're not necessarily getting those signals, so you could be comfortable, but it's damaging your eyesight, and you may not realize until later. So can't stress it enough. If you can view it with proper glasses, but if you don't, find a nice stream somewhere and watch it from there.
All right, we're in the zone of totality, so expect it to be busier than usual come Monday. All the details, hamilton.ca/solar eclipse to find out more. Ryan McHugh with his manager, Tourism and Events, City of Hamilton. Good luck, Ryan.
Thank you so much, and hopefully you find a nice spot to enjoy the eclipse yourself.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We certainly know in a post-pandemic world, the state of our healthcare system, and actually just a report today that wait times in Canada are starting to creep back up again, and that's right the way across the country. And obviously, a shortage of family doctors, you know the story. Let's turn the focus now on Ontario Medical Schools. The Premier wants Ontario Medical Schools to reserve the top spots, not for international medical students, but for Ontario medical students. Is that a good idea, a bad idea? Is there a balance needed? How do we do this? Dr. Sean Whatley with us, practicing physician, author of When Politics Comes Before Patients, Why and How Canadian Medicare is Failing, and a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute. Sean, as always, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thanks.
Your thoughts on what the Premier said? Good idea, bad idea?
Well, it seems like the response to what he said was a bunch of angry people looking for something to be mad about. They're confusing at least four distinct policy issues. So he said, quote, "I'm not being mean. I'm just taking care of," or actually said, "I'm taking care of our students, our kids first." So I suppose that's enough to make people upset. But really, if you read the analysis of what was going on, people, I think, are conflating four separate issues. So the first issue is Canadian students who have to study abroad. So Canadian students are really smart, really talented, well-balanced, and they can't get a medical school spot. So they go to study in the UK, Australia, Poland, Caribbean, or elsewhere. We've got about 3,600 of those students studying outside Canada because they can't get in Canada. The second issue is the number of foreign students in our system. So right now, about 18%. Now, if they are bringing funding from their home country, that actually helps our medical education system. So it's not clear whether he's talking about that group, or is he talking about another group of students who are actually stealing spots from Canadian citizens? And then the fourth issue we heard from the Migrant Workers Alliance, they said, "You listen, we're here in Canada. We might not," sounds like they're saying we're not necessarily Canadian citizens, but we should be allowed a spot too. So four separate issues and a whole bunch of anger when I think Premier Ford was trying to say some good news.
What was the good news?
We're opening more spots.
Yeah, exactly. 18% reserved or 18% taken up by international students. Is that too high, too low? Is that just right? Is there more balance needed there?
So the way I read that, and this has been a case, this has been the situation forever. We Canadian schools and postgraduate, so it's just like an apprenticeship, right? Our residency is an apprenticeship, just like an electrician or anyone else would do an apprenticeship. Doctors do an apprenticeship, we call it a residency. Well, Canada makes a ton of money by opening some of those spots to foreign students. So we'll take people from wealthy countries, let's say in the Middle East, and they'll come over and they'll not only bring a ton of money with them to pay for grossly inflated medical training spots, but they also do a ton of work. They do a ton of patient care. And then once they're properly trained, they go back to their own country. So it's not clear to me whether he's talking about that chunk of students or this other foreign student problem that we're hearing so much about in the media, where students actually apply to come in and take a position in a university that is openly competitive of one of the people who are already living here in our province.
It seems that each one of those, Sean, is an issue, is a problem.
Well, it's an issue for sure. I hope I described the first scenario as actually not a problem. We're getting free labor and we're charging them a ton of money for it. So people who come and to train in medicine, they're essentially working for slave labor. This is true of Canadians and foreign students. So they work 100 hours a week is not uncommon in residency, sometimes much more hours than that if you're a surgical resident. And you get paid $30,000 or $40,000 a year, which sounds like a lot, but when you work it out by the hour, it's actually very, very low. And so we are benefiting from some of this quote-unquote slave labor when we pull people in from around the world. Canadian patients are benefiting from that. We're also benefiting from the high tuition prices that we charge these foreign trainees. So I don't think it's bad net for the Canadian population. It keeps our training hospitals open, but that's a separate issue from foreign students competing with your son or daughter who wants to get a medical school spot.
So has it gotten out of hand? What needs to be done here?
Well, I think
if you had the premier's ear, what needs to be done here?
Well, I think the premier needs to be very crystal clear what problem he's trying to solve. Number one, more doctors for patients. Hey, that's a good thing. We rank 22 out of 27 when it comes to the number of doctors per population in Canada. We need more doctors. Number two, we need more spots for our own homegrown medical students instead of putting them, you know, several hundred thousand dollars in debt by training abroad. So if he messaged it that way, I think most of the population would support him.
But at the end of the day, should Ontario medical schools reserve how much or the majority, how much of their space should be reserved for Ontarians, how much for international students?
Well, you know what? It's total guesswork, and we've been guessing at this from the start. Ideally, we should leave it as a totally open market approach. You go to school, hopefully you'll get a job if there's jobs for you. But that's not the way we run things in Canada, right? We try to micromanage and guess how many doctors we're going to need. Famous Bearstotter report 1991 said, let's cut 10% of medical school positions. And then by the end of the 90s, we had 1.7 million patients without a family doctor in Ontario. So we continue to try to centrally plan this when every other training program, you just let the market determine it.
So is this story of relevance at the end of the day, or just, again, communications mix up?
Yeah, communications mix up. And like I said at the opening, I think it's angry people looking for something to be mad about, really. It's unfortunate that Premier Forbes didn't message it a little more clearly and say, hey, this is good news, more spots, more doctors, more care, patients are going to be happy. If he would have just stuck to that, I think it would have been fine.
Are we setting ourselves up to solve this issue, Sean? Are you seeing enough being done so more students are going through the system and then in the end, providing the care we need moving forward?
Not by a long shot. So even the announcements they recently made wouldn't put a dent in the current backlog of people without family docs for another 15 years conservatively. And then that doesn't even account for growth and aging and all the rest and retirement of docs. So it's a move in the right direction. But again, I think it solves a political problem. It's not solving a patient care problem. We need massive growth. And I don't think that the public is fully aware of that yet.
Seeing the story today, wait lists growing across the country, Canadian hospitals. We thought we had this nipped in the bud post pandemic. Is this just too many people chasing too few services?
We could do it that way. We could message it that way, describe it that way. But I think we're also shackling the people who are able to provide services so that they can't help as many people as they could otherwise. There's so many rules to follow, so many check boxes to tick that people are end up waiting in line, even though we have quite a few people that could provide more care.
Dr. Sean Whatley with us, practicing physician, author of When Politics Comes Before Patients, Why and How Canadian Medicare is Failing, senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute. Always fascinating, Sean. Thanks for the time. Be well.
You too.
We've talked about this a bit on the show as we've started to notice that the Prime Minister comes out and presents a problem after it was sort of his own policy that got us there and then tries to find a solution, kind of like showing up to the housing debate, like when a house is burning down, showing up with, you know, after the house is burnt to the ground, a pail of water and a ladder. I mean, it's very odd the way things work and how he positions what he has done and then tries to fix it. And there's a fascinating column in the National Post, Trudeau's weird habit of denouncing his own government. According to Trudeau, immigration is too high. The government is a poor steward of public money and the carbon tax is worsening affordability. And this is how it starts. In Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, Tuesday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau delivered a quick dissertation on how immigration was out of control. Temporary immigration has grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. He said, adding that this is driving up home prices, depressing wages, worsening access to health care. In other words, it's overstressing every single system that is already feeling stress by bringing in too many people. What he didn't say is that he's the one that allowed this to happen. He was told apparently 2 years ago from the Immigration Department, you got to tap You got to tap the brakes on these targets. You're going to set or even fuel more of a crisis in housing and healthcare, and it trickles down to the shelter system, all of that, and nothing was done. And now, oh look, we've got a cap on temporary students, we've got on international students, we've got a cap on temporary workers and such, which again are needed because of the policies that his government has put forward, basically capping his own targets. And it's an interesting point how he presents a problem as if, I don't know how this happened, but gee, we got way too many people here. So let's bring in Daniel Perry, Senior Consultant, Public Affairs, Hill Knowlton, and here now. Daniel, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Same to you, Scott.
Are Canadians getting this, Daniel? I mean, it's almost like the carbon tax check where, you know, if we cut the tax, you don't get the check. It's almost like, I don't know how we got here, but I'm going to get you out of it.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge that the government is facing right now. They're coming on to almost 9 years of being in government. And some of the policy and ideas that they had at the beginning of their tenure in government are not working out as they planned. And they're kind of having to readjust. And that's the role of government, is to fix the problem, sometimes the problems you've created yourself, and to make sure that systems are working for Canadians.
It appears that a lot of departments, a lot of files are being mismanaged. Is that accurate?
It's hard to say with the government this big. I think in the recent couple of years, the government has really taken a lot on the nose in terms of issues coming to light. I don't think COVID helped that, because when we were in COVID, what we saw from this government in particular was to just, we need to solve the problem, throw as much money at it, we'll deal with it later, and later is coming now. And I think some of the realities of the decisions that were made during COVID are coming through, and people are seeing that rash decisions were made.
We've certainly seen the Prime Minister walk back a couple of things, although you've got to figure that out yourself. He certainly won't come out and say that. Mm-hmm. With all of the mismanagement, and we're even hearing this on ArriveCan with auditor generals, what have you. And again, not the first time, yet doubling down on carbon tax, like, although I've screwed all of this other stuff up, this I've got absolutely right. How can that be? How does he square that circle?
I think that's the big question a lot of people are asking themselves right now. I think the carbon tax extends just beyond your usual tax measure, and it really addresses a broader issue that many Canadians are facing, and that's an affordability crisis right now. Many people are having a hard time filling up their tanks, or even filling up their fridges for that matter. And the carbon tax definitely isn't helping that. And the rebate that gets sent out quarterly now, people see that money coming to their account and it's not making a difference, because it's hard to make ends meet. And when life is becoming less and less affordable, an extra little bit of tax, you really notice that.
If denouncing his own government, should he be apologizing? If this is the strategy that they're using, like, gee, I don't know how we got so many people here. Mm-hmm. Is that the right approach, as opposed to, you know what, we misjudged here. We're going to do this. We're going to fix it. We're going to da 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 da.
I would love to hear a politician apologize, Scott. That would be a first day. But I think what the government's doing in this case, when especially it comes to this issue, is they're trying to find a way to bring back the tide. And they're realizing that they dropped the ball on this one, and they need to find ways to rein it back in, because like the Prime Minister said, if it keeps going, it's not going to work out well.
Is it too little too late? Has the Canadian public tuned him out? I saw an article today where young people have got to that mm-hmm. point. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think Abacus Data had some very interesting research on this that came out a couple of weeks ago. About 1 in 4 Canadians believe that Canada is headed in the right direction. So that means 3 out of 4 Canadians don't think it is. So I think Canadians are getting fed up and they're looking at their options. So whenever the next election might be, I think that's going to be the ultimate test if Canadians are buying what Justin Trudeau and his party are selling.
Daniel Perry with us, Senior Consultant, Public Affairs, Hill Knowlton, on an article in the National Post. Prime Minister has a bad habit of denouncing his own government. Daniel, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
Well, we've been talking at length over the last several months in regard to how auto thefts have just gone through the roof in southern Ontario, and right the way across the country for that matter. It was odd because the prime minister, who's some law enforcement officials call the catch and release prime minister, then headed up a large auto theft summit to try to stop some of this. And now we found out 598, almost 600 stolen vehicles were seized in Montreal in a container ship operation. What does this mean moving forward? Let's bring in Sean Sparling, retired deputy chief, Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently president of Investigative Solutions Network, and here now. Sean, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, no, it's good. I hope everything's well you're in.
So, Sean, did all of this happen at once? Was this the series of vehicles over the course of several weeks? Because, you know, obviously we went from zero to 600. How did this happen so quickly?
Well, I think it's quite obvious. This is a long-term project they had on the go. I can't say for how long it's been going on, but it's fantastic work. Nothing like arresting a bunch of bad guys and taking their toys back. But this has been going on for a while. That's large-scale projects like that just don't happen overnight.
So why are we seeing this large-scale bust now? Is this more focus on this, more money towards these sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure that the money's trickled into the system yet to actually have this kind of impact. I think this is a changing of priorities by law enforcement and really demonstrating what they can do best when they concentrate on a problem. And they have all the abilities and the resources, but they have the abilities to do these big, large-scale projects and do them well, and this is a demonstration of that.
Tip of the iceberg, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you'll see that they've disrupted probably a pretty good syndicate here. It may pop up somewhere else, but I think they've probably taken out a fairly lucrative conduit for stolen vehicles. That doesn't mean it's all going to stop today, but I think this is going to put it's a good start for sure.
We jokingly say whenever we see a container ship on a bar or one of those big barges or whatever, I wonder how many cars are in there. It seems like this is such an easy target, yet we've let it slip through the net. Does the port or the shipper hold any responsibility for knowing what's in those containers?
Well, I think so. To some degree, they certainly need to be part of the solution, right? Their facilities are being used for criminal activity, and they need to be part of the solution and come up with some creative ways to impact this problem for sure.
Are you surprised they made the dent they did here with 598, which seems, I mean, you know, we're not talking a 50 or 100 here. This is a large haul.
No, I got ahead of them. It's an impressive seizure for sure. I'm really happy to see that this has occurred and looking forward to some more. But again, it's a really good demonstration of what can be accomplished when they turn their mind to it. So,
is this something that we'll see a regular occurrence of, do you think, for the next little while till we get a handle on this? Can we get a handle on this? Because it seems if we're using the same investigative techniques or strategies here, that we'll come up with some more.
Yeah, I do think that you can get a handle on it. Like these large scale busts like this might dwindle somewhat. But it's going to come down to the willingness of other partners. This is not just a law enforcement issue. Like they're not going to arrest their way out of this. But certainly the courts have a big piece to do it. Public policy has a big piece to play in this. But the police are stepping up and doing their part right now.
So what will happen to these cars that have been found? They're already probably dealt with through the insurance company. The owners are probably driving their new version of their car that was stolen. Do these just get resold? What happens to these stolen vehicles?
They'll go back to the insurance company, and you'll probably see a lot of them either end up in auction or go back for sale. And if they haven't been claimed by the insurance company or reported the insurance company, they'll go back to the owners. They'll track them all down.
So you think there is a chance of an owner getting their car back here?
Yeah, if it hasn't gone through insurance, I think there is for sure.
So much for defunding the police, Sean.
Yeah, exactly. The defunding the police is just a political catchphrase that got some traction. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to core crime, police work, it takes money, it takes bodies to do it. And this is an example. You have to have the people in place to make the arrest.
It seems like every day you're seeing videos of people getting their car stolen, neighbors, your neighborhood or, you know, the town next door, what have you. With this size of bust, are we going to see a dent? Are we going to see things lighten up for a bit?
I'm not sure it's going to have a measurable dent today, but the continuing work of what they're going to do, it will. It'll have a continuing impact on it. The lasting impact is going to come down to what the courts actually do with these people and what the political will to actually change policy and change laws and stuff like that. But this this is a great start. So,
do a lot of these ground level criminals that actually do the stealing, do they end up back out on the street relatively quickly?
Yeah, they do, unfortunately. And our present laws with the, as you mentioned, catch and release, our bail system is weak in Canada. And these folks that are stealing cars can likely expect to be right back out fairly quickly, unfortunately.
Sean Sparling with us, retired Deputy Chief, Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently President of Investigative Solutions Network. 598 stolen vehicles seized in Montreal in containers. Amazing. Sean, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Great. Have a good night.
Lots to talk to Tasha Kieradin about. Journalist, writer with the National Post, G-Zero Media, and her Substack page, in my opinion, author of The Right Path. Tasha is here now. Tasha, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Thank you.
I'm going to try to plow through a lot here, Tasha. First of all, your thought on Justin Trudeau's pre-budget roadside attraction tour. Another day, another $1 billion out the door. What are your thoughts about unloading the budget before budget day?
Oh, well, it's smart because he knows usually budget day gets one day and everything is smushed together. So maybe you'll get two or three highlights out. You don't know what the media is going to pick. This way, he's going to have every day one announcement. Everyone will know it's in the budget. It'll be sort of not very exciting show when it's finished. But the point is he gets the media that he wants on the issues he says are important. So he's basically countering the narrative that he's not doing anything about all the problems that Pierre Poilievre blames him for. It's actually very smart politics, whether you agree with him or not and what he's doing, which I don't, but it's smart politics for sure.
Yeah, it's good to see that. And it's good to see that new communications department finally working for him. It is a brilliant idea. That being said, are we growing tired of him already?
I think we've already grown tired. I mean, you know, his leadership, there's like a leaders tracking poll that Nanos Research does. It's consistently going down. Like it's down, down, down. It's a negative trend for a couple of years now. And, you know, versus the positive trend the conservatives have with Pierre Poilievre has gone up since he's been elected. The NDP is kind of sort of the same and a little bit lower, but not a decline like Trudeau has. So we were already sick of him. It's quite clear. But he's not sick of us.
Already up to about $26 billion, I think. What about the price tag at the end of all of this? Will this come with some whiplash?
Well, I'm waiting for the money to be spent on the real priorities, things like, you know, national defense. Like, where is that? Are we going to have any money left over? I don't know. I think there will be some whiplash, and certainly it will provoke anger by people who think the government's spending too much. But what he's counting on is that so many people are having such a hard time that he's sprinkling this all over, like renters, housing, children who are hungry. Like, how can you argue against giving Oliver Twist the bowl of gruel, right? It's how heartless are you? The conservatives will have to vote against all this stuff because it's all together in one budget document. But by spreading it out like this, what he's going to be able to say at election time is, hey, the conservatives voted against that free lunch for your kid. How mean are they? So it's all tactics. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're all going to be paying for it, for his attempt to stay in power.
Another tactic is a rebranding or saying things like, if we cut the carbon tax, you're not going to get your check. and the other on immigration where, I don't know how so many people got here, but we got a problem on our hands when in fact it was his policy that did all of this. And there's an interesting article in the National Post about this today. Trudeau's weird habit of denouncing his own government. According to Trudeau, immigration is too high. The government is a poor steward of public money and the carbon tax is worsening affordability. It's like he has done all of this, but he's pretending to everybody like, I don't know how this happened, but I'm going to fix it for you. Are Canadians buying that?
I don't know if they will. I mean, the polls suggest they're not, right? The conservatives maintain a significant lead. I think it's 12% now over the liberals. So, no, I think but he hasn't tried this yet. See, this is, again, it's the pivot. They've been trying all sorts of things, saying how good the carbon tax is for you. That's not really working. I think they're recognizing that people are not happy with a lot of things they've done. So, they're saying, well, you know what? Maybe you're kind of right. Yeah, things are not great. And maybe we made a mistake. So let's move on. Let's fix that now. We're going to fix that. I don't know if people will accept they fix it. When you look at polling, it shows that people really, really think that the conservatives are the best ones to manage the economy, to be financial stewards, that they win hands down. So if Trudeau's going to fight an election on the economy, I don't know if it's the best bet, because they won't give him necessarily the benefit of a doubt.
It seems that the wheels are falling off in almost every department. I mean, like we've seen with the housing and immigration and how it's related to health care and trickles all the way down to the shelter system and such. It just seems that everything he's done, he's had to walk back in some way, whether admitting it or not, and usually not. How can we then have all of this confidence in him when it comes to carbon tax? You know, we've done everything else wrong. We're backtracking on everything from housing to whatever, but we've got this, we've got the carbon tax, we got the climate stuff. We're perfect on that. We've got it figured out. How are you supposed to believe that?
I don't think I think climate is good. Like they want to die on this hill. And I think that that's a miscalculation too, because the environment has dropped in terms of concern. People are more concerned about pocketbook issues. And you see, look, the announcement today that Ford is not going to be building those EVs in Ontario for 2 more years. Okay, it's related to the market because demand has slowed. People are not buying them. Why? They can't afford the price tag. They're concerned about, being able to use them in certain conditions. They're concerned about infrastructure to sustain them. Basically, they're just like, no, it's not worth the price, right? So that shows people are making pocketbook decisions over environmental decisions. For the Liberals to say that, it's got to green at all costs, like we're not going to sell LNG to Europe because, oh my God forbid, we invest in fossil fuels. When you've got reports from the Bank of Canada, or the Royal Bank, saying we need LNG at least until 2035, like, you can't get away from it. It's so myopic. I don't know what, I don't know what Canadians are going to do. Scott, I hope they come to their senses, but we'll see.
All right. Let's move quickly to the foreign interference inquiry. This just kept getting delayed. We remember this story broke with the Globe and Mail and the CSIS and all of that. And the Prime Minister saying, you're racist for even bringing any of this stuff up. Now, again, here's another flip flop saying that, we got a problem here. We got to work this out. Many thought this would get lost in the sauce because it was death by delay. Is that happening here? Because we're still hearing some stunning testimony.
We are. I hope Canadians are paying attention to this one, because this is not a pocketbook issue, but it kind of is, because it's a sovereignty issue. And ultimately, if you don't have control over your election system, if you don't have control over people who do foreign investment in your country, you are going to suffer economic consequences. You are not going to be able to make decisions in the interest of your country that are on all levels, whether it's economic or social or others, beneficial to you. So this is important. We knew 2 years ago what Erin O'Toole said again, which is that there were ridings the Conservatives lost because there was interference by a foreign government, China's, to pressure its members who are former Chinese citizens or citizens of Canada of Chinese origin, pressure them and give them disinformation to vote against the Conservatives. I mean, if anything, we should be outraged that our government abandoned these folks to a foreign government and its influence. Like, that alone is a scandalous thing. I mean, imagine if any other group was being treated this way. Why are we not furious about that? I think the Prime Minister has a lot to answer for on that score alone. But of course, he's only too happy to take money from donors from those communities and support from those communities at the ballot box. However, he got it. He didn't really care. And that's the saddest story of all.
Your thoughts when the Prime Minister responded to what Erin O'Toole said at the inquiry and saying basically it's sour grapes. This after CSIS already said there is interference. It's not sour grapes. There's proof.
You know what? Trudeau should be careful, because Sam Cooper tweeted out a photo today that it's actually been published before of him with someone who's very close to the PRC government and influence of these people in British Columbia politics. He has been in the company of a lot of people who've been essentially agents of a foreign government influencing our politics here. So a lot of people will start asking questions. Well, yeah, how friendly are you with these folks? Are you so naive, or was there something else going on? So he should stop before he throws rocks at Erin O'Toole. He should really be a little careful about himself.
Dasha Kiernan with us, journalist, writer with the National Post, G0 Media, and her Substack page, in my opinion, author of The Right Path. Tasha, as always, fascinating. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you. You too.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
Could not be better. How are you?
I'm doing well. So we all know, and you know what? Like last night, I'm watching Stephen Colbert, and they mentioned the Niagara Falls and Canada, not the United States, declaring the state of emergency for the eclipse. This thing's getting all kinds of attention, and not only in Niagara for tourism, but right here in Hamilton. We talked to Tourism Today, and they were saying that hotel rooms are selling out, blah, 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 blah. And like even at Tim Hortons Field, like 10,000 seats are gone. It's amazing.
So, we're going to be talking about part of what you're mentioning in the first hour of the show, because one of the things that I am finding a little bonkers is that we are not only having a state of emergency declared over this in Niagara, but there are people online saying you need to stock up on food and provisions and water.
Yeah.
And we've got other people, we've got the schools shutting down. We've got like, is this really, it's 4 minutes of darkness. Is this really a state of emergency? Now, that said, really cool thing. It's a really cool thing. And so I get that people are excited about seeing this. But yeah, it seems as though we may be losing our minds a little bit.
I was talking to Mayor Jim Diodati of Niagara Falls the other day, and he was saying that he wasn't even consulted on that. It was the region that came up with it. And what it does is it allows them to use more funds and gets more police and EMS peoples and such on the street. But that would be something they really probably should have explained.
Yeah. Here's my thing, Scott. I am going to be proposing that we start a pool. And we invite anyone who wishes to join us to participate to take your best guess on what's this at? It's at like at 3:18 p.m.,
yeah,
I think.
Something like that, yeah.
So by 6 o'clock, let's just by the end of day, all right, how many cases, Hamilton Health Science, of burned retinas they will have to treat because people don't do what they've been told? Or you've got the idiots who go, oh, you know what? I'm going to do social media. I'm going to stare right at the eclipse for social media clicks, man. There's going to be, I bet you there's going to be dozens, if not hundreds of people who screw this up and end up having to be treated.
So you think it's going to create eye issues?
Oh, Scott, they have specifically said, do not stare at the eclipse. That's like telling a lot of people on social media today, stare directly at the eclipse for as long as you can without blinking. You know that.
Well, that's what Donald Trump did, but
it's inevitable that there are going to be people who are going to say, this is awesome. I'm going to do this and show. I have a feeling that they are going to have ocular specialists, whatever it is, eye doctors, on specialists on standing by for this one, because there's going to be enough dumb people.
I don't think I would feel safe staring directly at the sun, no matter what sort of I was like, you know, go get the glasses, go get those cheap pair of glasses. And by the way, you can't tell which ones are real and which ones are fake.
Well, you can.
Like, oh, damn, I got the wrong ones. I burned out my eyeballs.
Okay, I got a pair yesterday. And
How do you tell?
Well, the thing about these ones, and I thought I actually had broken ones, like ones that were defunct, is because in regular light, you cannot see anything. They are pitch black.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's, you know, because it's so bright that this will just allow enough, I guess, light to come through. I don't know if I said this to you yesterday. I mean, I do feel like since I have gone now and picked up a pair of glasses,
yeah,
it's inevitable that it's going to be cloudy. If I had not picked them up, it was going to be gorgeous. But, you know, but look, it's a cool thing. I don't dispute that it's a really cool thing. Do you remember what they said was the next time we're going to see this? It's decades and decades and decades.
Well, so it happens all the time in other parts of the country.
Sure, but just not
us,
here.
But yeah, for us to be in the path of totality. Or zone of totality. Yeah, it does not very often.
Wow, listen to you, Mr. Scientist. Get the right words and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And another, don't use your 3D glasses. They don't work. Those 3D glasses, they don't work for the, you need something different than that. Well,
there go my plans.
I go red and blue. Look at that.
You can't use those 3D glasses from John Candy and the Dr. Tongue's House of Horror?
No.
Okay, that's SCTV. With Joe Flaherty dying this week, I've been thinking about SCTV a lot.
Dr. Tongues. Oh my God. All right. So, to me, I don't think the experience is going to be staring at the sun. I think the experience is going to be in the opposite direction, watching what happens here, watching what happens when all of a sudden in the middle of the afternoon it turns dark, what animals do, what pets do, what happens, what it looks like, seeing the streetlights come on. I don't think, you know, all you have to do is watch, you know, a science thing, doc or whatever, and you'll see, you know, safely on your screen at TV what it's going to look like after it's happened. I have no desire to look up at the sun. For me, the curiosity is what everybody else is doing, watching the sun. It's like my first time I went to a World Wrestling Federation, it was called back then, match. It's like, you know, the show is not in the ring. The show is watching the audience.
Yeah, especially the front row. There's an old joke about that. What has 400 legs and 12 teeth, the front row of a wrestling
front
match.
Row.
Here's the other thing about this. I am going to be, if you do turn around and look at the people, here's the other thing I'm going to be amazed by, how many people are taking pictures of this, which we're also hearing potentially could burn out your camera. So I've become convinced that this eclipse has been sponsored by Apple because of the millions of new iPhones that are going to have to be purchased after this thing.
You're going to be burned out.
But again, if you're there, so this Scott to me seems like, you know, I say this all the time about a lot of things that we miss a lot in life because we spend our time looking through the camera as opposed to just being there and experiencing. I'm not saying don't, you know, if you're on a family getaway, of course you take pictures and all the rest, but we spend so much time. You're right. This thing, there will be professional photographers. There will be all kinds of images of this. You can, I know this is hard for some people, myself included, but you can put down your phone and just experience the moment without having to take a picture. You can download a photo after. I guarantee you there will be lots.
I don't need to burn my eyeballs out to see this. Phone. All right. There you go. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. Anthony has our last word via email. Lots of talk about the upcoming solar eclipse. If you're coming to the Hammer to watch, stay off my lawn. Anthony, keep right except a pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.